Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man from whom I have learned prodigiously about the war for the free world, particularly the home front aspects of that war, and most especially the vulnerability of one of the key elements of our security, indeed of our existence as a nation, is our first guest. He is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, perhaps best known, at least of late, for his appearances on Mark Levin's new program on Fox News. He appeared there several weeks ago, and I understand he's coming back by popular demand this weekend. It's Sunday evening, I believe it's 11 o'clock, is it, Peter?
Yes, that's right. 10 o'clock, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Mark Levin will be, he'll be replaying an interview that we had just a short while ago.
Terrific. Well, let me finish my introduction. Peter Pry has been a very active contributor to the national security for a long time, notably in some 20 years or so at the Central Intelligence Agency, also as a member of the staff of several House committees and activities commissioned by them, notably the House Armed Services Committee and the Commission on Electromagnetic Pulse Threats. He has also served and is currently serving as the executive director of the Congressional Task Force on National and Homeland Security. He's the author of numerous books, including, among the most recent, Apocalypse Unknown, The Struggle to Protect America from an Electromagnetic Pulse Catastrophe and Electric Armageddon. Well, with all of that said, Peter, welcome back, and thank you for joining us. It's nice to hear that you're getting a reprise of your very, very impressive performance on Mark Levin's program a few weeks ago, and congratulations on both.
Well, thank you, Frank. It's always a pleasure to be interviewed by a person like yourself, so well-informed, but also a very important activist on trying to protect our country from EMP and nuclear threats, Russia and China.
Again, much of that is what I've learned from and been inspired by your own work, Peter. Just tell me a little bit about the threat as you've seen it and described it on Mark's program, among other places, that, again, for most of us, Peter, the reliability of the electric grid is such that we take it simply for granted that it will always be there powering essentially every aspect of modern life in the 21st century America. Why is it that the grid, as it's called, is so vulnerable, and specifically to what?
Well, it was never designed. It was built by the private sector, and it's been built over many decades in a piecemeal fashion. It was designed for profit, and it wasn't designed ever with the idea of national security in mind, and that this thing would be absolutely vital to the preservation of our electronic civilization. It's also because of a lot of environmental restrictions on the ability to build new sources of electrical generation. And as our population has grown, there are more and more demands on the grid, and it's getting older and older. Most of the transformers, the big transformers that are in the grid, are about three quarters of the way through their useful service life. And so naturally, when you've got a situation where the grid is so big and it's so old and there's more demand on it than it was actually designed to deliver, we've actually seen the grid fail due to heat waves and just excessive demands on it.
To say nothing of enemy action. Peter, the problems that are inherent with the grid, and you've mentioned this critical node, I guess is the way I think of it, transformers, high-voltage transformers. Would you just describe for laymen like me what those are and why they are so vital and so vulnerable?
Well, there are two technologies that are foundational to our modern electronic civilization. One of them are these extra high voltage transformers. They enable you to take electricity from someplace like Niagara Falls and then project it down at long distances to New York City, for example, where there's another transformer to the end of the line that steps the energy down so that it can be consumed locally. And then there are as a technology called a SCADA, for Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition Systems. These are little computers that regulate the way electricity flows through the grid. And in fact, all of the critical infrastructures, water, gas, even traffic control systems have got SCADAs in them. And the SCADAs and the transformers are all vulnerable. They're both vulnerable to EMP, as are, frankly, almost all electronics in our society, unless they've been specifically designed and hardened to survive an EMP event.
Okay, so you've introduced this term electromagnetic pulse. Let's just take a minute to parse that as well. An electromagnetic pulse is a phenomenon that you've studied closely for decades, Peter, and helped explain to the rest of us. Give us a quick layman's definition again, if you would, of that phenomenon and what generates it.
It's like a super energetic radio wave that's got so much energy in it that it will destroy electronics. It'll pass harmlessly through people's bodies and doesn't pose a direct threat in that way. But if you're flying on an airplane and the electronics go, you can come crashing out of the sky. If it destroys the electric infrastructure so we don't have any food or water anymore, millions of people would die from starvation and disease. And it can be caused naturally by the sun. We're most concerned about a geomagnetic superstorm that happens once every century or so, like the 1859 Carrington event. This could destroy electric grids worldwide and put billions of lives at risk. We're concerned about a nuclear EMP attack that could be done by Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, if it gets the bomb, or terrorists. Anybody who gets their hand on even a single primitive nuclear weapon could do this. One nuclear weapon detonated at 300 kilometers altitude over the United States could put a EMP field over all of North America, putting electronics at risk over that entire area. And then there are non-nuclear EMP weapons called radio frequency weapons that have more localized effects. But even these could cause a nationwide blackout if you knew which transformers to attack. Just a handful of them, perhaps a dozen of them at the right place at the right time could basically take down the national grid and end our civilization.
Wow. Peter Pry, we're going to have to pause here for a moment. You've graciously agreed to give us a second segment, so we'll be able to drill down a little bit more on several of these incredibly important points, and most especially to talk about why, after your years of warnings, those you've individually made and those of the EMP Threat Commission for which you've worked and many others of us, we still have these vulnerabilities and are still, therefore, very much at risk. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, the Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security, the author of Apocalypse Now, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're continuing our conversation with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, a former Central Intelligence Agency analyst and congressional staff member, a professional staff member, that for the House Armed Services Committee, also the executive director and driving force behind several of the threat commissions looking into electromagnetic pulse attacks and dangers for the United States Congress. He is the author of several books, including Apocalypse Unknown, The Struggle to Protect America from an Electromagnetic Pulse Catastrophe, and Electric Armageddon. Let me ask you, Peter Pry, if I can. You've described several of the threats that we have to worry about. There are physical attack possibilities. There are cyber threats. There are electromagnetic pulse vulnerabilities from both man-caused sources and naturally occurring ones. The vulnerability that persists, despite what you and your colleagues, Dr. William Graham and others on the EMP Threat Commission, for example, Dr. Hank Cooper, a frequent guest on our program, and others have done so much to document over the years, is very alarming, it must be said. And yet, here we are, since 2004 at least, these warnings have been made public. Why is it, Peter Pry, that we haven't done something to rectify the vulnerability of the transformers and other elements, the SCADAs and other elements of the electric grid?
Complicated question, Frank. The book Apocalypse Unknown, 300-page book, explains all of that. There are many reasons, but Vice Admiral Robert Monroe, who used to be the director of the U.S. Defense Nuclear Agency, has an excellent article in today's Washington Times that explains an important part of the reason we're not protected. And Monroe points out that during the Cold War, you know, we had hundreds of experts working for the U.S. government on EMP, although it was a subspecialty among nuclear weapons experts. But then when the Defense Nuclear Agency was disbanded under the Clinton administration, we lost a lot of that expertise. In fact, we lost all of it. And we don't really have EMP experts working in the government anymore. Most of the expertise that remains is working for the EMP Commission. As Vice Admiral Monroe puts it, a handful of people in their 80s. And so you've got a handful of EMP experts and strategic experts and intelligence officers who have in-depth knowledge about EMP that were serving on the EMP Commission. And against them, you've got thousands of government bureaucrats who've never heard of EMP, are ignorant of EMP, and are easily misled by frauds in the electric power industry, and even within the Department of Energy, Obama holdovers from the Department of Energy and the national labs that have tried to lowball the EMP threat so they don't have to do anything about it. And your typical bureaucrat doesn't know who to believe. Do I believe these guys who spent decades and have advanced degrees and they learned about EMP from nuclear tests and all the rest? They're obviously the ones you should believe, as Monroe points out, or do I believe these young analysts, Obama holdovers, or people that are still working in the national labs that tell me, oh, it's not so bad and I don't have to worry about it? Naturally, they would much rather ignore the threat if they have that option. And there are people around that are willing to provide them with rationalizations to ignore the threat. And that's part of the problem. You've also got a huge problem from the electric power industry.
Well, and that's what I wanted to ask you about next, is the electric utilities, which, as you say, have been the prime movers behind building out this electric grid of ours and own most of it, some 85%, I believe, you would think would be as interested as anybody in ensuring the resiliency of all their assets. And yet what you've described is an industry, a constituency, a community, if you want to call it that, that seems to be lowballing this threat and actually, if I understand you correctly, opposing corrective action that might make these assets, in fact, survivable in the face of the sorts of threats you've described. What's up with that, Peter Pry?
Yes, well, that is not a surprise because the private sector, and I'm a big believer in the private sector and free enterprise, but historically, every industry has always sought to avoid government regulation, has sought to maximize short-term profits, and you know, when it's faced with the choice of investing in public safety or pursuing those short-term profits, they invariably will pursue the profit motive. I mean, that's few historical examples. You know, the Zeppelin industry in the 1920s, you know, convinced itself that it was perfectly safe to travel by hydrogen gas balloon when helium was available. And the decision put them out of business after the Hindenburg exploded. You know, we didn't get seat belts and safety glass in automobiles because of the decisions made by the private sector. They actually had to have these things imposed upon them by the Department of Transportation. The Bhopal, India, the greatest industrial accident that ever happened. When Union Carbide wanted to manufacture pesticides, it didn't want to follow the regulations in the States, and so that it went to India, where it wouldn't have to follow those regulations and take certain safety measures, and they ended up killing almost as many people as died in Hiroshima as a consequence of the enormous, as a consequence of the release of pesticides into the local population in Bhopal, India. Trusting the electric power industry to protect the grid and on the idea that we don't have to worry about these threats to the grid would be a lot like trusting the cigarette industry and on lung cancer back in the 1950s and 60s.
Yeah, we've kind of gotten away from this as a practice, haven't we? For I think of Teddy Roosevelt and the trust busters, saying that we're not going to let interested parties self-regulate, and yet we're still doing that in this case under the rubric of something called the North American Electric Reliability Corporation. Peter Pry, it's a group that apparently sets the standards and largely drives such regulation as this this other body, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, also known as FERC, that kind of oversees. But as I understand it, it more or less serves as a rubber stamp for the Electric Utilities Trade Association, if you want to think of it that way, NERC.
That's right. I think political scientists call the phenomena regulatory capture. The U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission basically is comprised of lawyers and lobbyists who used to work for the electric power industry. But you look to the founding fathers, who were the ultimate libertarians. They believed in small government. They wanted that government governs best, which governs least. And as a conservative and a Tea Party Republican, I certainly believe that. But even the founders understood that you cannot do without government, because we need government for national security and homeland security. You can't look to the private sector to provide those things. You know, that's what the government is supposed to do. And that's one of the few things that NERC, the electric power lobby, says that is true. They say it's not our job to protect the electric grid from nuclear EMP attack and cyber attacks and foreign threats. That's the job of the U.S. government. It's not our job to do that. And they're right. But the way the government needs to protect it is not by making appeals to the patriotism of NERC, but by passing laws and regulations to compel these guys to do the right thing and to help them do it. We can allow them to raise rates, or the Department of Defense or Department of Homeland Security should pay, for hardening the grid and DOD, the Department of Defense. That's where we still have the most expertise in the U.S. government, could do it for them, to actually go in there. And I wouldn't trust the electric power industry, frankly, to take the steps, even if they said that they could.
Or were willing to do it. Peter Pry, let me just ask you, because we'll run out of time before we run out of things to talk about with you. You are a national treasure, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of your expertise in these matters and your ability to articulate what's wrong with this picture and what we need to do to fix it. So let's turn to that question. What is it we most urgently should be doing to try to ensure that potentially, as you say, millions of us are not doomed because the power grid is not resilient against these sorts of threats, physical, cyber, electromagnetic pulse, what have you, that we could, as individuals, or better yet, as communities, be mobilizing to try to ensure gets done by the federal government, gets done by state governments or others, the utilities among them, presumably, to protect us?
At the federal level, the EMP Commission has recommended that the president, President Trump, appoint an EMP critical infrastructure security czar, a person with the authority and resources and with the backing of the president to organize the government and work with the utilities to compel them to protect the grid and arrive at a solution there. And this could be done also, the important first step, by having the president sign an executive order on national EMP protection that was drafted for him by the Congressional EMP Commission. I would not wait for a solution at the federal level, however, because we all know the federal government, Washington, doesn't do anything well, except unless it's President Trump. But at the state and level, people can organize. You can protect an individual state, even if it's part of a larger regional grid. And I've written a book called Blackout Wars that explains how to do that. In fact, it was the chapters are written by various state senators and state representatives who launched initiatives to try to protect their state grids from EMP. And you can learn lessons not only from their experiences, in some cases they succeeded, in other cases they failed, but there are blank executive order for a governor and a blank bill in that book. All you have to do is fill in the name of your state. And if you could get the governor to sign that executive order, or if you could get your state legislator to pass that bill, it would basically start you on the path to protecting your state from EMP.
Peter Pry, is there a website associated with your task force on national and homeland security where people can learn more about all of this?
EMPtaskforce.org.
There you go. You can also check out securethegrid.com. The Secure the Grid Coalition is a pickup team of national security-minded folks led by and greatly helped along by Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. Thank you so much, my friend, for your time today.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by Trevor Loudon. He is an extraordinary man from down under, a Kiwi by birth, from New Zealand, but a man who now, I'm happy to say, spends a lot of time here in the United States, among other things, warning about what is happening in our country that in ominous ways seems to track with some of his experience in his native land. Specifically, the rising impact and growing menace of what he calls the enemy within. That would be specifically social democrats, communists, for that matter, Islamists, who are in some cases the same people, but all of whom are engaged in something that he's described in a recent series of articles at his website, trevorloudon.com, the New Zeal blog, as he calls it. Tell us about this rainbow conspiracy, as you've dubbed it, and its genesis and its implications, Trevor.
Yeah, well, what I talk about is back in the 80s, you had a strong Maoist movement in America, and one of the largest groups was a group called the League of Revolutionary Struggle. And they were pro-Chinese, very Marxist-Leninist. But what they did, they decided to go into electoral politics, and they moved into Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition in 1984 and 1988. And they held key leadership positions both times. They basically ran it for Jesse Jackson. And what their thesis was this, is that you, as a Maoist, you work to unite the minorities, the blacks, Latinos, Asian Americans, Native Americans, Muslim Americans, gay Americans. And this was the basis of Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition, you know, brown, white, black, yellow, green, lavender. This is how they termed it. This is their terminology. So Maoism sort of collapsed in the late 80s, but what happened to the League of Revolutionary Struggle? They formed a new group called the Unity Organizing Committee, and they specifically moved into the Democratic Party. Now you have a guy called Steve Phillips out of San Francisco, who was one of these people, who married into the very wealthy Sandler family from San Francisco. These are the people who fund the Center for American Progress and other big Democrat organizations. And with this money, he is reinventing the Rainbow Coalition for the century. Now, the minority proportion of the population is much bigger now. So what they're doing is running candidates of color. They're behind Kamala Harris and Senator Cory Booker. They're both planning to run them for president. They've elected several senators, such as Mazie Hirono from Hawaii and Congressman Mark Vasey from Texas, etc. And now they're pouring huge resources into the southern states that have high black, Latino, Native American populations who don't normally vote, and their plan is to take out the Republican Party by taking out its soft underbelly. I'm talking Florida, North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, all states that are trending blue, and even Texas.
Yeah. And when you say they're trending blue, that means they're states that have historically been more Republican, at least for the past few decades, but they're becoming more up for grabs, if not actually disposed to vote Democrat. And this is being done through, as I understand it, a very intensive grassroots campaign of recruitment and indoctrination and running candidates. And they have as a common denominator a pretty hard left ideological bent. Is that right? And are Islamists in the mix as well in all of this?
Look, absolutely. Look, for instance, if you look at the Alabama race recently, the Alabama Senate race, when the Democrat Doug Jones defeated Roy Moore in a shock upset. Now, Roy Moore was a very damaged candidate, and he should have easily won that election. But when they saw he was damaged, Steve Phillips and his people poured hundreds of volunteers and millions of dollars into Alabama. They signed up thousands and thousands of Black, Latino, and Muslim voters. And the leader of CARE in Alabama boasted that they had won the election for the Democrat, for Doug Jones, because he won by 20,000 votes and they signed up 20,000 Muslim voters and got them all to vote for Doug Jones.
Yeah, this is, to be clear, a candidate who was widely regarded as a fairly conservative Democrat. So you're saying that these people were prepared to throw in support of him, even though they were not presumably aligned with his ideology, simply to try to defeat a conservative Republican and turn that Senate seat blue?
Well, to make it harder for President Trump to get his agenda through, because every Senate seat, not in Republican hands, makes it so much harder. So they will go for moderate Democrats where it's strategically suitable. But like, for instance, in Georgia, they're holding the primary for the Democratic governor's nomination today. And this group, Power Pack, is backing Stacey Abrams, who is a hard left candidate. And she is almost certainly going to get the Democrat nomination today. They're backing Ben Jealous for the governor of Maryland, who's hard left. They're backing Andrew Gillum for the governorship of Florida, who's also hard left. All of these people are related to this group called Power Pack. They are funded by Power Pack. They have Marxist or Maoist backgrounds in most cases. But as you said, occasionally they will back a more moderate Democrat if it's in their strategic interest to do so.
And I do want to ask you, Trevor Loudon, because this is almost certainly shocking to most of our listeners, as indeed it is to me, the extent to which we have now, in this polity of ours, a large, it seems, and growing number of people who are of the radical left, not progressives or liberals or moderate Democrats, but people who are pretty far over on the extreme. Progressives probably fall into that category too, don't they? But talk a little bit about this, the sort of ideological lineage and characteristics of some of these folks.
Well, look, if you look at someone like Kamala Harris, who is going to be, who these people are engineering to be the Democrats' presidential nominee in 2020, her sister, Maya, was at Stanford University with these people, with Steve Phillips and his Maoist friends. She was actively involved with them. They got behind her because she's a hardcore leftist, and they basically got her into, they elected her to the Attorney Generalship, I think, of California, then into the U.S. Senate from California. And they also got her brother-in-law appointed as the deputy head of the Justice Department under Eric Holder, a guy called Tony West. So these people have the ability to not just select candidates, but to also place dozens of hard leftists into the federal bureaucracy. And they had a whole bunch of people in the White House.
Under Obama specifically.
Under Obama, but also even under Clinton.
Yeah. And I think it's fair to say that at least some of them have burrowed into parts of the bureaucracy and are still there exercising influence under Donald Trump.
They are still there. You know, Donald Trump the other day did a justice reform conference, and one of the key guys there was Van Jones. You know, this is about emptying the prisons, and Donald Trump brought into this, and Van Jones is very much part of this network. He's an old Maoist, part of the Steve Phillips network, very close, and he is able to influence the Republican president. They still have a lot of people in the Justice Department, in the House HUD, all sorts of government departments who are still working in tandem to basically wreck the Constitution.
And we're going to talk more about this in the next segment, but I did want to just introduce the point, Trevor Loudon, that there are quite a number of individuals who have this sort of pedigree or ideological leaning, shall we say. In the Congress, you've mentioned Kamala Harris as one. But I did want to just commend to the audience your terrific book and documentary film, both titled The Enemies Within, as an incredible resource on the sorts of people that have been elected by the American people from various districts and states around the country. Give us a sense quickly, by way of introduction to this topic, Trevor, of how many of these folks you have identified in just the Congress of the United States alone, and talk about the background checks that they receive.
Look, there are at least 100 members of the U.S. Congress and more than 20 members of the U.S. Senate who are so enmeshed in neo-communism or Muslim Brotherhood front groups, or often both, they couldn't pass an FBI background check to drive a school bus. But the thing is, there are no background checks in Congress or the Senate. And guess what? America's enemies are taking advantage of that loophole.
And as we'll talk about in the next block with Trevor Loudon, these are people who are serving on committees in the Congress with responsibility to oversee the most sensitive intelligence and national security activities of our government. And to the extent that they are actually not, you know, able to pass the most basic of background checks, as you say, for a school bus, that's a problem. We'll have a quick and very important conversation about this, including some case studies of the problem, with Trevor Loudon, the author of Enemies Within and of the NewZeal.com blog, trevorloudon.com. Check it out, folks. Valuable information here, and more coming up right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Our guest for this second segment is Trevor Loudon. He is a great resource from originally New Zealand. He is spending a lot of time in our country, fortunately, helping to clarify what is going on inside what many of us call the swamp in Washington, by dissecting, if I can use that expression, some of the toxic environments and what they generate in terms of politicians and public officials of other stripes who could not pass, as Trevor says, a background check to drive a school bus in this country. Trevor, again, thank you so much for your time today and for staying with us for a second installment of this conversation. Give us some examples, if you would, of people who fit the profile you're talking about, who have not been subjected to background investigations and probably couldn't pass one if they were.
Exactly. Well, there's several examples that come to mind, but if you take Luis Gutierrez, for instance, who's a congressman from Illinois, he was a former leader of the pro-Cuban Puerto Rican Socialist Party. He was a supporter of the League of Revolutionary Struggles and involved in the Rainbow Coalition. He's a big-time supporter of CAIR,
the Council on American Islamic Relations.
Yeah, Muslim Brotherhood Front Group. Yet he served on both the Judiciary Committee, which oversees the FBI, and the Intelligence Committee, which oversees all 16 of America's intelligence agencies. You know, on that agency, you've also got Andre Carson, the rep from Indiana, who has extensive ties to several Muslim Brotherhood front groups, CAIR, ISNA, ICNA. We've got him on film saying this at an ICNA convention in Connecticut in 2012. He gets up in front of the crowd, he smiles away and says, "I understand there are people in the audience who are watching us. You think we are here, you are watching us undercover because you think we are here plotting to destroy this country. Well, I say to you, Allah will not allow you to stop us."
Yeah, it's a pretty shocking video. I've seen it.
Yeah, well, this guy's serving on the Intelligence Committee right now. You know, and say Karen Bass, the congresswoman from California, been to Cuba multiple times, was a former supporter of a Maoist communist group called the Line of March, very dangerous group. And Tammy Baldwin, you know, the senator from Wisconsin. You know, she has been a long-time active supporter of the Colombian Support Network, which is a support group for the Colombian FARC terrorists who are known as narco-terrorists because they make their money to fund their revolution in Colombia by selling cocaine into your country. And she has used her position in your Congress on many occasions to try and get U.S. military aid cut off to the Colombian government so that communist movement can succeed, so they can send even more cocaine into your country.
And Trevor, let me just tease this out a little bit with you. These are people who have longstanding, as you say, personal associations with very problematic groups. Are you actually suggesting that their judgment or their agenda or their loyalty to our country is questioned? Or should be questioned by our government?
I'm not suggesting it. I'm saying it outright. You know, there are multiple people currently serving this country who owe more allegiance to Cuba or to the Muslim Brotherhood or to China than they do to the United States. Multiple people, which is why America has so many problems.
Yeah. And if you were advising, say, Donald Trump, or for that matter, the Speaker of the House or the Majority Leader of the Senate, what would you say to them about these individuals who are members of the Republican Party in some cases, mostly, I guess, members of the Democratic Party, but who are very problematic, let's be clear, and whose loyalty you're questioning that, you know, are nonetheless casting votes on and overseeing U.S. government policy? And as I said earlier, Trevor, some of the most sensitive programs of our country for both homeland and national security.
Well, I think one of the first steps would be, you know, Donald Trump would say, you know, if you want to serve on the Intelligence Committee or the Education Committee or whatever, you need to be checked out by a panel representing several intelligence agencies, and you need to have undergo the same scrutiny that you or I would have to undergo to have access to that sort of information. And if they balk at that, if they refuse to take to undergo that scrutiny, well, therefore they cannot be appointed to those committees.
Now, when you say the Education Committee, that's not something that typically people, I think, would say is a particularly sensitive place like intelligence or armed services. Why would you point that one out?
Well, because these people have huge, like Raul Grijalva, for instance, from Arizona, who has written for the Communist Party newspaper. He's been involved with the Communist Party for decades, yet he's a senior member of the Intelligence Committee. Well, what kind of people is he appointing? What kind of programs is he approving? Where is he directing money? You know, we know that political correctness is taking over the colleges and the high schools and is turning out thousands of young socialists every year. Well, what role does the Education Committee play in that? And what role do you think Raul Grijalva plays in it? Of course they're going to promote their agenda. That's what they believe is right and proper.
Right. And you have written about and warned of for years, Trevor Loudon, one of the places where the march through the institutions, as the cultural Marxists have called it, has been most pronounced and has continued to have profound effects, including, I would argue, you know, the election of some of these sorts of people, is in our schools, our public schools, yep, most especially. And while we're spending a lot of time, understandably, worried about the safety of our kids from, you know, shooters, in some ways, it's the curriculum that is really as dangerous, certainly to our polity, our republic, if not personally to them, as anything else.
Well, they did a survey recently, and they said that had only 18 to 25-year-olds been allowed to vote in the 2016 presidential election, I think the Republicans would have won three states. So you are getting a whole generation of young children. And I'm just using that as an example. But you're getting a whole generation of young kids who now hate America. They think America got rich by ripping off the third world, and that America was built on slavery and tyranny, and America is not worth defending. American values are bad, are corrupt, and that the only answer is some sort of socialism. That's why the Democratic Socialist of America has gone from 7,000 members to 35,000 members in a year and a half.
And a great many more sympathizers, presumably, at least if this evidence that Bernie Sanders, who is among those Democratic Socialists, as I understand it, and the support that he currently enjoys among millennials is any guide.
Well, exactly. And then if you look at Bernie Sanders, you know, what is the difference between Bernie Sanders' Democratic Socialism and full-on Marxism? The difference is about 5 to 10 years. You know, Bernie Sanders is a Marxist. He's a hardcore Marxist who works with the Communist Party, who has worked with terrorist groups in the past, has traveled to Cuba and Nicaragua and the Soviet Union, and back in the day,
honeymooned in the Soviet Union, as I recall.
Honeymooned in the Soviet Union. Who does that? Bernie Sanders is not a democratic socialist. Bernie Sanders is a hardcore communist. But he's got hundreds of thousands of young people thinking he's the best thing since sliced bread, which just indicates the cultural shift that has happened because of the indoctrination that's happening in the schools now.
So one more time, if you were advising our president or our congressional leadership, what would you encourage them to do? Is it to institute background investigations? Is it to make sure that these people are at least determined to have the kinds of associations that should disqualify them, whether they're, you know, the decision is taken to disqualify them or not?
Well, see, right now the law, the FBI will not investigate sitting congressmen for political offenses. That has to be changed. Also, another thing that has to happen is the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a terrorist organization working basically legally in the United States, has to be declared, as President Trump promised to do, has to be designated a terrorist organization. Because you've got a whole bunch of congressmen and senators who have interns working for them right now that come straight out of the Muslim Students Association, a Muslim Brotherhood front, working in their offices, and some of the most high-ranking senators and congressmen in the country.
Trevor, we are out of time, my friend. I appreciate so much the opportunity to visit with you. Come back to us again soon, and I hope the rest of you will do the same. Tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.